You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/the Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free. Welcome to the Director Series podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
Do you know what kind of a camera that is? What it's called?
It's a home movie.
Arriflex is called. Napoleon is still in his grave, waiting to be brought back to life. I wonder what Napoleon would think of Lou Wasserman and David Picker.
Same.
Whether he would like to have them passing judgment on his life.
After the success of 2001, Kubrick started working earnestly on a long-gestating passion project, Napoleon, an epic biopic that would have starred Jack Nicholson as the infamous French emperor. Kubrick had spent most of the 60s conducting an exhausting amount of research for the project, and by the time he was finished, he had an elaborate note card system that detailed Napoleon's exact movements, one note card for every single waking day of his life. However, right as cameras were preparing to roll in 1969, the project fell apart, and the subsequent year's failure of a similarly themed Napoleon film named Waterloo killed any chance Kubrick might have had in reviving the project. Even today, Kubrick's unrealized Napoleon project still haunts the film community as one of the greatest films never made. Kubrick was now faced with the task of finding a new project to develop in the wake of Napoleon's failure, and he turned to a book that Terry Southern had recommended to him on the set of Dr. Strangelove, a book Kubrick had initially dismissed as incomprehensible. That book was Anthony Burgess's seminal novel, A Clockwork Orange. Looking at it with new eyes, he was drawn to the book's dystopian setting and its examination into the psyche of a violent young man as a byproduct of his environment. As he had done with 2001, Kubrick served as his own producer as well as his own screenwriter in adapting A Clockwork Orange to the screen. The film is a curiosity within Kubrick's body of work in that it is very faithful to its source novel, whereas Kubrick had a reputation for dramatically altering source material to fit whatever given movie he wanted to make. This can be credited to the fact that Kubrick disregarded his own script and worked on set using the novel itself, an uncharacteristically haphazard approach for the notoriously disciplined director, but it fit with the lo-fi improvisational nature of the shoot.
The Durango 95 purred away real horror show. A nice, warm, vibratory feeling all through your gutty woods. Soon it was trees and dark, my brothers, with real country darkest. What we were after now was the old surprise visit. That was a real kick, and good for laughs and lashings of the old ultra-violent.
Clockwork Orange is at its core a character study, which places a significant burden on the shoulders of its young star, Malcolm McDowell. Under Kubrick's steady hand, McDowell turns in a career-defining performance as Alex, the twisted, psychopathic antihero at the center of the story. While his crimes are vile and reprehensible, it's a testament to both Kubrick's vision and McDowell's boyish charms that we as an audience ultimately find him sympathetic, and, dare I say it, relatable.
It was my rabbit to help the prison Charlie with the Sunday service. He was a bolshy, great, burly bastard, but he was very fond of myself, me being very young, and also now very interested in the big book. I didn't so much like the latter part of the book, which is more like all preachy talking than fighting and the old in-out. I like the parts where these old Yehudis tolchok each other and then drink their Hebrew vino and getting onto the bed with their wives' handmaidens. That kept me going.
McDowell's devious characterization of Alex results in one of the most influential and iconic film characters of all time, a status that still stands today, judging by the cues Heath Ledger took from McDowell for his portrayal of the Joker in The Dark Knight. McDowell isn't the only actor in the film, but his performance towers over every other cast member to the point that one would be forgiven for thinking otherwise. That's not to say that the other cast members don't pull their weight and help fill out Kubrick's nightmarish, dystopian version of the future. Patrick McGee and future Darth Vader David Prowse are notable standouts. Working with cinematographer John Alcott, Kubrick trades the polish and gloss of 2001's visuals for a decidedly lo-fi indie aesthetic. Tonally, the visuals of A Clockwork Orange play like a hybrid between Kubrick's clinical, restrained classical style and a hyperactive Saturday morning cartoon. For instance, Kubrick and Alcott exposed most of the 35mm film image using only natural light, resulting in a lifelike, down-to-earth look that features pops of color amid drab, neutral backgrounds. However, in those same shots, he also uses wide-angle lenses to distort and exaggerate reality to unrealistic proportions. This is also reflected in the camera work, which alternates between static wide shots that observe the action dispassionately and up-close, handheld shots that bring the objective point of view firmly into the subjective. A Clockwork Orange's reliance on natural light seems peculiar, if not entirely out of character, for Kubrick, whose reputation for controlling every aspect of his image was infamous. However, this development can be ascribed to two defining aspects of Kubrick's artistic aesthetic. Kubrick was well aware of his superlative talents, and saw each project as the definitive film in his particular genre. So when he saw the wave of scrappy, low-budget youth films streaming out of Europe and America during the late 1960s, films like Dennis Hopper's Easy Rider, he decided that he would adopt the same affectations in an effort to deliver A Clockwork Orange as the ultimate youth picture, much like he had done for the sci-fi genre in 2001. Additionally, Kubrick's interest in natural light didn't stem from light itself, but rather in the technological advancement of lenses that required less and less of it to properly expose the film negative. This speaks to the pioneering aspect of Kubrick's craft, his constant push to eliminate technical limitations on the realization of a filmmaker's vision. This approach is mirrored in The Edit, where Kubrick and editor Bill Butler brazenly cut from distant observational setups to dynamic handheld shots that bring the action up close and personal. Kubrick uses the expressionistic nature of his edit to creatively portray the film's most violent aspects, such as the murderous bludgeoning of the cat lady. Instead of showing us the act itself, Kubrick cuts away to a series of rapid shots of the cat lady's paintings, strung together in such a fashion as to suggest animation. Clockwork Orange's editing was highly influential, forecasting the rise of rapid music video-style editing popularized by films of the 90s and the aughts, as well as the stylistic flourishes of filmmakers like Quentin Tarantino and Oliver Stone. The world of A Clockwork Orange affords Kubrick several opportunities to further develop his aesthetic.
So far, the first film was a very good professional piece of cine, like it was done in Hollywood. The sounds were a real horror show.
The frequent usage of narrative voiceover, one-point perspective compositions, and extended tracking shots, sometimes even the combination of the two, such as the shot of Alex roaming his beloved record store, are the clearest visual indicators of Kubrick's hand. He also experiments with a few new techniques, like the breaking of the fourth wall, or filming from the floor up at someone leaning over a closed door. A very unconventional, somewhat disconcerting angle he would turn into a trademark. Like his previous three films, Kubrick shot A Clockwork Orange in England, both in London and around his home in Elstree. He recruited John Barry as his production designer, who adapted existing locales to fit the needs of the story, rather than build entirely new sets. To convey the dystopian feel of Kubrick's vision of a future Britain, Barry sought out socialist-style housing projects in municipal buildings built in the brutalist school of architecture. The cold, uninviting concrete structures stand like oppressive symbols of a society that has allowed youths like Alex to run amok, a society that's lost any interest in civic infrastructure or social betterment. Kubrick contrasts this with the interiors of Alex's family flat, a garish mishmash of bright colors and patterns that suggests a counterculture struggling for its voice in the absence of a unifying message. The production design of A Clockwork Orange suggests a very different future than the one Kubrick depicted in 2001. Indeed, this future is decidedly earthbound and considerably more cynical. Wendy Carlos, credited here as Walter before her sex change operation, fashions the score for A Clockwork Orange as a blend between Baroque classical compositions and computer-age instrumentation. Alex's love for classical music is reflected in the appropriation of works like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, filtered through the inspired use of a Moog synthesizer and vocoder that makes it sound as if it were being sung by a computer. This perversion of music's inherent beauty extends to the inclusion of Singing in the Rain, which runs over the end credits in addition to being sung by Alex as he brutally rapes a woman during a home invasion.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again.
Kubrick's filmography is littered with music that plays counter to the actual image it accompanies, but A Clockwork Orange is really where he perfects his surprising, brilliant concoctions. Our perception of Singing in the Rain has been permanently discolored, seared into our collective memory as the sound of impending doom. Kubrick peppers the soundscape of A Clockwork Orange with a sort of audiovisual irony, giving a twisted elegance to the carnage on display. Kubrick's career-long meditation on sex and violence takes center stage in A Clockwork Orange, what with its depiction of a seemingly lawless future society and explorations of conditioned behavior. The character of Alex is the result of a hypersexual culture, a culture that is implied through the pervasiveness of penis popsicles and pornographic pop art displayed in the homes of otherwise respectable, upstanding citizens. Perhaps as a prediction of the nascent birth control movement, Kubrick's vision of a future Britain is a world in which sex has been stripped of consequence, and thus exists merely for titillation and self-serving gratification. In other words, it is simply for entertainment. Whereas bored teenagers of the 1970s would find entertainment in hanging around drive-in movie theaters and cruising the main strips of their hometowns, the bored teenagers of A Clockwork Orange get their kicks in the form of indiscriminate rape and torture. Rape is a particularly salient theme for Kubrick to explore, precisely because it is the intersection of sex and violence. It perverts the act of love into an act of hate, and Kubrick's somewhat humorous yet ultimately horrifying depiction of it forces us to reckon with the darkest parts of our own humanity. Man's capability for inhumanity towards his fellow man and woman is reinforced by Kubrick's exploration of the inhumanity capable of institutions, civilization's invention to protect man against himself. The brutalist architecture of the socialist housing blocks, cold, concrete structures with no personality or history reflective of their inhabitants, reinforces the purely utilitarian reasons for the existence of institutions. In their efforts to create a stable civilization and strip man of his wild nature, they overreach and subsequently take away a man's ability to govern his own behavior.
I've learned my lesson, sir! I see now what I've never seen before! I'm cured! Praise God!
The sacrifice on behalf of the individual for the greater good of the societal whole is a common theme that runs through Kubrick's work. Films like Paths of Glory, 2001, and Dr. Strangelove all examine the inhumanity of institutions towards the individual. A Clockwork Orange still stands today as Kubrick's most controversial film by any standard of measure. The violence and carnage on display was shocking and far exceeded anything that had been made up to that point. In the wake of its release, public furor over its content and real-world copycat crimes prompted death threats on Kubrick and his family, leading to his voluntary withdrawal of the film from UK cinemas. An embargo that would last until his death in 1999. In America, the film was a runaway hit, and secured a nomination for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. With the divisive success of A Clockwork Orange, Kubrick's reputation as a daring maverick auteur was assured. If he wasn't already the figurehead of the new wave of radical filmmaking sweeping the world, he was now.
Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.